another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy we did a basketball thing well week.
We did a basketball thing very well, actually.
Yes.
If you've lived under a rock or haven't paid attention to Syracuse, which then I guess you're a disloyal idiot, Syracuse knocked off Duke at Cameron Indoor. You can question whatever you want about the end of the game. We've all been on the other end of that against Duke in Cameron. I don't care. We win. Duke loses. All is right. And Syracuse suddenly looks very, very good, even if flawed, once again, just as we saw in the beginning of the season, Dan.
I think Syracuse is almost becoming the official basketball team of the 2015-16 college basketball season, in terms of looked pretty good but flawed. Like, the season makes no sense. Syracuse makes little sense. But I agree. I mean, there's no one's apologizing for the win yesterday. Obviously, there were the two, I guess you call them controversial, but I don't see a universe in which case the Malachi Richardson bumps into Matt Jones play is called a foul. And I don't, you know, if you're calling a foul on the very late heave at the buzzer, that's pretty iffy too. Though Trevor Crooney should not have tried to give that foul as late as he did. But overall, I mean, I went and crunched the numbers that night because I couldn't go to sleep. Pretty much like 78% of the teams that have won at Cameron during a year have gone on to make the tournament. The asterisk to that is that most of those teams weren't really on the bubble, and there were a couple recent bubble-ish teams that didn't make the tournament, but overall it's a pretty good indicator that a team is both good enough to beat a Duke team there, which there are many years where Duke has not lost to Cameron at all, and that the team is good enough to make a run to the tournament. So I think we're in much better position, and most of the metrics will lend to that as well.
Yeah, I was taking a look at that spreadsheet you had put up, and the weird thing to me was that Miami's done it, what, twice in the last four seasons, which is weird.
2012 and 2015, let me actually pull it up. 2012 and 2015, they both beat Duke at Cameron, both missed the tournament, and I think there was both like 19 win teams-ish. I have it open now. So yeah, the recent, I went back through all of the 64 plus team tournament era games, and there were 40 Duke lost at Cameron 42 times in that time span, and the teams that did not make the tournament were a 14-13 1985 Wake Forest team, 95 Clemson, 95 NC State. That was the year where Coach K went out with he had surgery and Duke just fell to shit and lost a lot at Cameron. Then there's 96 Illinois, 97 Michigan, 05 Maryland, 07 FSU, 2012 Miami, and 2015 Miami. That's the list. So most teams that went at Cameron make the tournament. Most of those teams are, I think, like two-thirds of those teams are like top four seeds, which is probably a lot to ask of Syracuse now. But overall, like, Syracuse joined the list of a lot of one seeds and a lot of very good teams.
Yeah, and you know, I'll take being in that company. I mean, I don't think that we're out of the woods yet in terms of being a bubble team, even making the tournament. Or, I mean, who knows? Like, you know, you and I were talking about in the very brief pre-show, the solution to every problem in college sports or any sports is win. Just, you don't have to worry about what everybody else is doing. You don't have to worry about what your resume looks like. If you keep winning games, you're going to get into the tournament. You're going to go further. And it seems like Syracuse is pretty well situated to do that, at least right now. I know Seth Greenberg over on ESPN was talking about SU's bubble profile and really, really was kind of singing their praises because, you know, you don't want to hate on Hop, but you do want to point out at the same time that Syracuse's actual coach this season, Jim Boeheim, is 9-2 with three wins over ranked teams. And I don't think that's going to be discarded. I think some people are skeptical about how much the committee actually put stock into it. I personally think that while it's going to play a role, it's not going to play – I don't think that is going to be the thing that makes or breaks. But if we, you know, we keep winning, if we play at a rate that we should and we win at a rate that we should, I think that that's going to weigh – it's going to weigh well in SU's favor if you know, Boeheim has three or four ranked wins on the resume versus, you know, the kind of rough stretch we had with some difficulty, obviously, under Hopkins.
Yeah, and someone from the committee, I forget who it was, said, like, went on the record to say that they will take it into account. Now, how much they do is you know, a question. But if you break down the resume into, like, those two parts, it really is interesting because Syracuse with Boeheim, I think overall Syracuse has five wins over top 100 RPI teams, and that includes, like, St. Bonaventure, who's sneaky pretty good this year, and Wake, who is, like we said, after we won that game, like, they looked awful, but they're not awful. But with Boeheim, I mean, Syracuse has win at Cameron, which I think by the end of the year will look way better than it does now, because I think with Emile Jefferson healthy, that's a top 15 team. And they're, you know, people have a – it's hard for everyone to keep track of when everyone with an injury was out and played and what teams won games shorthanded or lost games shorthanded. So I think just at a long view, a win at Duke looks good no matter what. And that Duke team will be fine by the end of the year. And then the win over Texas A&M, like, looks great because they're number, I think, 8 in the coaches poll and 10 in the AP, and they look like the best team in the SEC right now. So, and those were both with Boeheim on the bench. So it'll be interesting to see how they weigh things. But if the Boeheim factor plays at least, like, really any kind of factor in their decision-making, it looks really good for Syracuse. And we can worry about the long-term repercussions down the line. But in terms of making the tournament this year, I think, you know, we have to feel better than we did a week ago where we had two wins, but, you know, BC and Wake only count for so much. Duke is a big one.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you look at the upcoming schedule. I mean, Virginia is going to be a tough game coming up. If it's played on Saturday, we'll see what weather holds. But, you know, looking at everything else, there's a nice stretch in there where we could conceivably not only get over 500 in league play, but get a few games over 500. I think the key is for SU to finish at least 9-9 in league play. Obviously, they already racked up that Duke win. Another upset against one of the other favorite teams would be, I'm not going to say sealed. I think if they win the games as opposed to and pull another upset, it'd be very hard to count out Syracuse, especially if you look at, you know, the Hopkins versus Boeheim split. The fact that A&M keeps winning, it can only be seen as a net positive for us. You know, like you said, when Jefferson gets back for Duke, that's another positive. I think UConn, obviously SMU is the class of that league, and it won't matter because they won't be playing in a league tournament, and they won't be playing in the NCAAs either. So UConn could very well, you know, find themselves as a top five seed or so themselves. Like, this is, you're looking at three really notable wins away from the Carrier Dome, and that's not something you can typically even say about a Syracuse team. So I think that that's going to be something, you know, held by the committee. I think it was OU's AD that had mentioned it, that, you know, the Boeheim factor was going to be weighed. But yeah, Syracuse is not out of the woods again, but it is looking much, much better. And you have to like, and I'm going to mention it again because nobody seems to buy in on the blog. The Clemson loss is not going to hurt us.
No, Clemson looks like a, you know, they look like a pretty decent shot to be a tournament team right now. I mean, they obviously just lost the other day to who beat them? Virginia, which was by 7 on the road. That's not a bad loss at all. But Clemson, I mean, they started kind of slow, but they've really turned into something. And Jaron Blossom game looks like an all-ACC performer, which, you know, he's been a nice player for them for a couple of years, but it does, you know, he wasn't anything like that. And Landry Noko looks like a pretty, you know, a force inside for them, type of center that a lot of people don't have. So they're a nice little team. And losing to them by 1 in overtime, like you said, probably won't be the thing that keeps Syracuse out of the tournament if they don't make it.
Yeah, I mean, that was a game they should have won, obviously. But at the end of the day, you know, Syracuse still controls its own destiny. Like most other teams in the country, you keep winning, you have a shot. And that's all that matters. I think that, you know, there's going to be a crowded bubble. It's going to be a lot of ACC teams on it. But I think these things will sort themselves out. It seems very unlikely, even in a wacky season like this, and we can go into that in a sec, that you know, the bubble comes down to six ACC teams, all with very similar resumes. That would just be too much of a statistical anomaly to really believe in right now.
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard to beat on it so far, but the Big 12, I feel like, is getting most of the press because they have the three teams right at the top. But I think the ACC, we've talked about it for a couple of weeks now, like, aside from BC, there it's a pretty really solid lead top to bottom. Maybe no great team aside from North Carolina if they stay healthy, but a lot of pretty good to good teams. So I feel like depending on what the selection committee feels about the league, it's either going to be a league where it's like six or seven teams, or it could be a year where you get like 10, 11, like we saw with some of those old Big East, years down the stretch. I don't know. I'm a little afraid of the ACC cannibalizing on itself and everyone just looking too mediocre and a lot of teams getting left out. But hopefully we are the ones doing the eating and not being eaten in that scenario.
Oh, of course. And I think, you know, a lot of this too depends, and we said this a little bit last week, like Syracuse isn't used to sitting on the bubble and things like that. We just haven't done it in a few years. And the interesting thing this time around is going to be, you know, we're back to, I think, where we were in 06, 07 or so, you know, seeing how many tournament favorites win and all that. I think in a year like what we're seeing, you know, in 2015-16, where you really can't bet on anything. I mean, every night, you know, one or two ranked teams are losing to unranked teams at home. And it's wild. It happened again tonight where, you know, West Virginia and Kansas went down in a brutal Big 12. I mean, right now I'm watching the Baylor game, and Baylor and Kansas State are battling it out in double overtime. Baylor's ranked. Like, there's just a lot. There's a lot of parity, and it's not just the big leagues either. It's also a lot of the smaller leagues. And you look at, there's actually a really solid number of mid-majors and low-majors that have, you know, sizable resumes. I mean, you look at, I think Monmouth is a perfect example of a low-major who really stacked its non-conference resume. And, you know, usually if you get feasted on whatever, it kind of hurts you for any at-large bid. But when you win those games, and Monmouth managed to win a bunch of them, you suddenly have a very, very nice resume, win or lose your league. But, you know, Syracuse, not used to this again, as we've spent most of the last 8 or 9 years kind of, you know, hanging around higher seeds. We're going to have to be rooting for all those tournament favorites, even more so than normal this year.
Yeah, and just about the craziness, I'm looking down at stores now. Texas, like you said, beat West Virginia. Michigan State lost again to Nebraska, who's not very good at all. Villanova and Seton Hall. And Seton Hall's not bad, but they're in a kind of a dogfight right now, 2-point game with 9 minutes left.
DePaul beat Marquette tonight.
DePaul won a game. Good for them. yeah, this season, like, if you guys haven't been paying attention, if you've kind of been sucked into the NFL or college football, like, obviously I love those things too, but this college basketball season, like, it's only November, so it's early to say. In March, you know, every year it's either, like, totally crazy or kind of predictable, and that kind of defines the year. This year has been maybe the craziest regular season through January 20th that I can remember. It's insane how many top five teams, I think it's like 19 top five teams have lost already this year or something. It's bizarre.
Yeah, I think the numbers are around there. I know five number one seeds have already lost. I think I think this is going to be the first year maybe ever we see a one seed with probably four or five losses. It could be all the one seeds could have four or five losses at this point. I mean, I could poke a hole in every single one of probably the top 10 teams in the country, especially because, you know, they all have losses to look at, and not just one. It's a handful of them. Like, last year, Kentucky was obviously the class of the country, but also benefited from a very easy SEC schedule, and you saw them fall victim to some things. But, you know, it's one thing to fall victim. It's another thing to actually lose because of them, and it took a very, very good Wisconsin team laden with seniors to knock them off in the Final Four. This year, you're just seeing, no matter who gets to that top line, there's just something. Each one has just a big weakness, and you know, we talk about it every year, I feel. It's just, the tournament's a matchup game, by and large, especially because of how big the tournament's gotten and because of how deep the country's gotten in terms of talent. And, you know, some of these ones, and I'm not going to start playing, you know, 16 seed wins this year, but some of these ones match up with the wrong team. They all have a wrong team that we're going to see clearly come March. It's going to be very, very intriguing to see all this play out.
Yeah, those the 8-9 games, the second round games for the ones are going to be mighty interesting because I just don't think there's that much separation this year. And you've seen like 8-9 type teams beat ones already. So like we said, there's been 5-1s go down so far. So buckle up. March is right around the corner. It's actually like it feels like March already with how these games have played out. It's nice to have a good college basketball season. I feel like we've had some very predictable ones as of late, and this regular season just is anything but. So nice to get some craziness injected early, especially because craziness, you know, kind of helps Syracuse this year because things started so poorly.
Yeah, you know, how the one thing I think that started to been addressed around the country, but not necessarily in earnest, is how much do you think we can attribute that to the 30-second shot clock and whether or not coaches and teams have been able to adapt? I mean, you see it sometimes with players when they first get to the pros that there's an adaptation that needs to happen when it comes to the shot clock. But for all these college basketball players, I mean, yes, it's just a young game in general because of the one-and-done rule, but do you think that there are certain teams or programs or anything or players maybe that have struggled to adapt a little bit if they play a slower style offense?
I haven't noticed it too much. I mean, at the top of the polls, like it seems like faster teams are generally playing better. Oklahoma plays fast. UNC is always athletic. Kansas plays at a pretty good pace. Villanova, Xavier. So I don't know if it's benefiting those teams. I do think, like, having watched the game, I think the games are a little more pleasing to watch. But I don't know that I've noticed, like, slower teams struggle. I mean, Virginia's had a weird couple weeks, but they were really hot to start the year. And there's a couple other teams that have been pretty good that play at a slower pace. But it seems like this year the faster-paced teams have been more successful. I just don't know if that's a product of those just being the better teams this year or if the 30 seconds has had a major impact. I don't know. Having watched a bunch of games, I don't know that I'd attribute it to that too much, but I will say as a fan, I think I've enjoyed it a lot more than what it's been in the last couple of years. You definitely see a little more running, more deliberate offense than what we've seen in years past where teams were just, you know, eating chunks of time, dribbling the ball up at the top of the key.
Yeah, you know, I I've been noted on this podcast that I kind of almost completely stopped watching college basketball's regular season outside of Syracuse games the last couple of years because of how much of a crawl and a slog it became. Luckily, there's a very good, very competitive NBA product out there outside of whatever game the Warriors are playing in that night. But yeah, I think what I've noticed more than the offensive end is on the defensive end is you're not seeing bad defenses rewarded, but you're seeing very good defenses rewarded in that I think what we saw with the zone is that the longer shot clock, you know, that final 5 seconds, and we never had the numbers completely, but in those final 5 seconds, that would be when the defense finally wore down and offenses were able to set up, you know, these BS corner threes or just being able to cut through the lane after not being able to do so for the first 30-plus seconds. So I think you're seeing a lot of, I mean, in the ACC alone, I think there's, what, 5 defenses that are letting up less than 70 points a game. And I think it's the typical suspects, you know, it's Virginia, it's Syracuse, it's Louisville, and some others. But you're seeing those teams rewarded because of the shot clock isn't giving bad shooting teams time. It's helping out offensive rebounding teams, obviously. But I think the penalizing bad shooting teams who can't just keep tiring out a defense, I think is one of the best products of it, and it actually makes a lot of these kids much better suited for the pro game long term.
Yeah, it rewards good shot selection, it rewards ball movement, and it's not just, you know, wait till 5 seconds left, chuck something up, etc. I also feel like we've seen less like long drawn out foul fest at the down the stretch. I feel like things have been officiated, if not a little more loosely. It's just obviously there are individual plays where really bad calls have been made. Last night there was, or Monday night there was definitely one on who was it that got called for the charge? Benajay, the third foul on him.
Oh yeah, that was deplorable.
Awful. But overall, like, I feel like we don't see quite as much of, like, get the ball inside and they just call a foul, anticipatory fouls. Obviously, it still happens, but a lot less fewer games are being decided, like, exclusively on the free throw line, which is nice, at least based on what I've seen. And that's also a thing as a Syracuse fan that I'm welcome because our team's awful at it.
I guess moving a little bit into this weekend's game, again, assuming it happens, one, can we give Virginia their third consecutive 69-62 game? And two, do you think that the SU's kind of recent, I wouldn't say offensive resurgence, but at least I want to say they found a little bit more of a rhythm under Boeheim in the last probably couple weeks. But do you think that we stand a chance against Virginia, or is this a Virginia team that is about to hit its stride as we get to the meat of the ACC schedule?
I think it's a good Virginia team. Obviously, they've struggled a bit recently. They have three losses in the last five games. Virginia Tech, which seemed like a weird loss at the time, and I think they're still better than the Hokies, but the Hokies have shown some life recently. FSU is super talented and not all that consistent. They're getting destroyed by Louisville. And Georgia Tech is not very good, but again, like, there's no one that's truly awful in the ACC except for BC.
And even they tested Miami tonight.
Yeah, they're working on Miami. You know,
they're up 11 now. It's fine.
Miami's up 11. Yeah, so I think Virginia's good. I don't think they're as good as they have been the last 2 years, but I think it's interesting to see how we play them with the new shot clock, because they've done, like, their Virginia thing to Syracuse real bad the last couple of years, especially, like, down the stretch of games. But talking about going back to your you know, you brought up that the offense looks better. I don't know what's done in the Malachi Richardson, but he's been so good the last, what, five, six games. And I think that'll be big against Virginia. They play that pack line defense. If Malachi can hit some shots from the outside, that's huge. I think, obviously, Cooney continuing to be a factor will be nice. So I think we definitely have a chance. I think any game against Virginia could end 69-62, no matter who it is, because Virginia doesn't often let up more than that, and they also don't score more than that all that often. I don't know that I'd, you know, give us a tremendous chance to go down there and win, but I don't know that winning in Charlottesville is all that much tougher than winning at Duke, except that Virginia is healthier right now than the Blue Devils are. But I think it's hard to not be encouraged by how Syracuse has looked the last three games. So, yeah, why not?
Yeah, you know, I think we stand a chance. I mean, I said it before the Duke game, you did too. Like, we stood a chance because of the minimal rotation. I mean, if there was one team that had a lesser rotation than SU, it was Duke. I think Virginia doesn't really pose that same issue for themselves, because I think they have a lot of quality rebounders. They have some size. Doesn't seal a win. Obviously, you know, if Syracuse is going to make the sort of mistakes they made against Duke early and late, I don't see them being able to pull off a win. I know SU has a little bit more rest, but that I don't really think. I think, you know, once you get down to maybe a matter of a day or so, it's incremental. It doesn't really matter. I think Virginia is an interesting team because, you know, this is a Virginia team that has lost to Florida, lost three road games, but Florida State, Virginia Tech, Georgia Tech. Florida State was supposed to be a top 25 caliber squad this year. That hasn't been the case. I know right now they're getting absolutely smoked by Louisville. I think Georgia Tech is not good, but again, like you said, not bad. This Virginia group looks like they're probably going to lose 7 or 8 games this year, which, again, not bad. It's they're not a bad team. It's just when you look at what they've done previously, they just don't. They're not the same level of suffocating. And maybe it is a product of the shot clock. I mean, I just haven't watched the games closely enough to really diagnose it. If that's the case, I'm not overly optimistic for this weekend, however, and that's probably a bummer to a lot of people here who are banking on SU, you know, just riding that momentum to reel off a couple big wins in a row.
Yeah, I think the interesting factor with them, I'm really interested to see how Virginia tries to attack the zone. I feel like they've done a really nice job of doing the, you know, get the ball to the high post, kick, you know, kick out to the shooters, get the ball to like the play that UNC ran over and over. They don't have quite the same big men that the Tar Heels do, but I think they've done a nice job of like doing the fundamental things that teams do to beat the zone. But overall, the team, I mean, they shoot 40% from three. And I'm just looking through the stats now. London Perantes, who's a very good point guard, but hasn't been like a crazy shooter the last couple of years. I saw he was shooting 56%. And I thought that was like, oh, he's just not shooting the ball this year, so he's just made a high percentage. No, he's really shooting like 55.6% from three. And like he took 9 threes against Virginia Tech and made 7. And he went 4 for 7 against FSU. Like, this is terrifying. And I haven't watched that much Virginia this year. But
with
they
good
do
reason.
Have, yeah, well, I actually don't mind watching Virginia. I think, you know, I appreciate what they do, even if it's not the most fun thing to watch. But they do have a really nice mix of players and a nice mix to beat Syracuse. They have 2 really quality post guys in Mike Tobin and Anthony Gill. They have Malcolm Brogdon, who's like the do-it-all dynamic forward. They have Perantis, like I said, who apparently is like Steph Curry now, but also a really solid, consistent point guard. And they have some nice shooters off the bench. So it's a well-crafted roster, I think. I just don't know that they don't seem to have like that X factor that they have in years past. And like maybe it is partially the shot clock. Maybe they're just kind of regressing to the mean a bit. But I think it's still a very dangerous team.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing we did, and I think we'll do before halftime, is and this is something you and I talked about when Hire was first made, and I think it's now coming to fruition, which is crazy. Virginia Tech. Buzz Williams is a good coach. I know we hate him. I know he somehow has our number, no matter who he's coached on that game we had to face them in the second round.
For so many reasons.
For so many reasons. We've discussed it here before. I don't want to keep belaboring the point, but that was BS. Buzz has our number. Also goes to show that Marquette is, for the most part, a trash program that just happened to you know, hit on 2 straight coaches. And now you look at the state of them in a retooled beast.
Are we saying that Tom Crean is a coach that can be, like, that can be a hit?
No. Tom Crean was a successful head coach.
He was.
He was a head coach at a then mid-major program.
He had Dwayne Wade, and that's...
That's it.
That's the story. Dwayne Wade's good. I think that's the Tom Crean story. If you have Dwayne Wade, you will win some basketball games.
You're Dwayne Wade, and you are able to lord over a mid-major program and get a very lucky trip to the Final Four. And yeah, that'll do it. And that you can hit your ride to that rocket. And then, you know, just at the same time, summarily burn Indiana basketball to the ground even more than they were already. So, I mean, no, we're not at those depths yet. I always love seeing Indiana basketball lose. I like seeing Marquette basketball lose as well. So, Tom Crean and Buzz Williams, we'll see what happens at Virginia Tech, have done their jobs and then some.
I actually have nothing inherently against Indiana, aside from their fans were pretty annoying down at the Sweet 16 when we ripped their heart out and fed it to them. And they all wear those stupid striped pants. Like, all of them wear those. And, like, they're warming up for the game. It's hilarious. But just Tom Crean. Watching Tom Crean lose is one of life's great joys.
Well, because the Crean face always shows up. And it's
so many faces.
It's always a delight to watch. It's amazing to me that the Big Ten has been able to rise. I think this is just a weird part in general for the Big Ten football and basketball. In football, the Big Ten has largely been able to rise without Michigan really being a factor, except for 2 of the last, like, 6 years, last season, and then the one season Brady Hoke, you know, screwed over the Hokies in the Sugar Bowl. On the basketball front, the Big Ten has really surged and is probably neck and neck with the ACC, you know, from a talent standpoint. But that's largely without Indiana's help. And considering Indiana was very, very, you know, pretty much its entire existence, that the strength of the Big Ten, and then it had assistance from Michigan State, from Ohio State, Michigan, others, at various points. It's crazy to me how Indiana's been down for so long now, and outside of that one seed they had when we knocked them off, they've largely been down for a very long time, and the Big Ten's still been able to improve without them.
Yeah, it's just bizarre, and it doesn't make a ton of sense because, like, they've recruited incredibly well. That team this year has a lot of talent, and they're actually playing pretty well recently, but it's just funny how every time it kind of looks like they're, you know, getting ready to win consistently. Even the year where they were the one seed and we beat them, it's just they just fall back to earth in such a big way. And it all goes back to Crean. And then Crean just does just enough to keep himself there, which is fun too. Like, it wouldn't be as much fun if Crean had just gotten fired 3 years ago. But his constant, like, yo-yoing between job securities and, you know, being at the top of the college basketball world and then falling back to earth and climbing back up like Sisyphus, it's just a fun thing to watch. And their fans just are so, like, they're very hard to – they swing probably more than ours even do in terms of their feelings about the team.
I feel like Indiana basketball fans are the Nebraska football fans of college basketball.
It's tough. Nebraska football fans, I feel like Nebraska football fans are, like, too far removed at this point. Like, for, I think if they had come closer to, like, actual national relevance, maybe.
Fair.
But now they're just, like, trying to get back to, like, 10 wins.
That's fair. We'll find a comparison for you yet, Nebraska and Indiana.
I'll think of it as we go on.
And on that note, it is halftime. Here at the podcast, as always, we discuss what we've been drinking. So Dan, spill. What do you drink last weekend?
Not a ton of exciting new things, but the one thing I did try, which I hadn't had before, which was during the Syracuse Duke game, from Shipyard, who I haven't had a lot of stuff from them except for their pumpkin, which is wonderful. They have an IPA, Little Horror of Hops, which was quite good. It was almost, you know, a bit of a standard American pale ale. It obviously had like the hoppy, you know, IPA bitterness, but was nice and drinkable and had a very clean aftertaste. Not you know, didn't the bitterness didn't like linger like crazy too long. So that was like the one thing that I tried, which was I could definitely recommend as a more drinkable IPA for those who aren't, you know, huge fans of that beer type. That might be one that could kind of ease you into it.
Fair enough. What was I drinking? I had Four Calling Birds. It's a strong ale, a Belgian strong ale from the brewery. It's from 4 years ago at this point. They had their annual holiday where they run through the 12 days of Christmas, so that was four. Also had MASH, the Bourbon Barrel Aged Barley Wine from last year from the brewery. Went to a Kings game over at the Staples Center, and beforehand got to check out the Beer Camp Tropical IPA from Sierra Nevada. That'll be featured in the Beer Camp Across America box later this year, hoping to get to the festival that they have going on in L.A. They're going to have it at five other spots. Closest to you is Boston, I think, Dan. Which is probably not feasible.
Not all that close to me.
No, not all that close at all. Some other things that I drank, I went down to Beachwood Barbecue and Brewing, had Amalgamator, which is always an excellent IPA from them, had Tart Simpson, it's a mildly tart Berliner Weiss, really got a lot out of that one. Also had Joint Venture, Pizza Port, which is down in, they have Carlsbad location, and I usually end up at the San Clemente one because if there's one I'm going to, that's only like an hour and a half away versus the rest that are much further. So Pizza Port comboed with Beachwood for a Joint Venture IPA. Nice collaboration. Had This Sour Future from Smog City the other night. It's an Ode Brewing, so kind of like a, you know, mildly sour brown that was very good. And also had Sap from Treehouse Brewing in Boston, well, not Boston, but the Massachusetts area. It was originally a Christmas IPA, and now it gets brewed a little bit more often. Still very, very good. So yeah, that was my my full roster of beers for the past almost week.
little Northeastern flavor for you this week.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. Kind of weird. That's what happens when I ship a decent amount out, help out some folks with a little trusteeship, and then in return, I get some good Northeast beers, which I usually can't get much access to out here. But yeah, moving on to the second half. I don't know. Dan, pick your poison. We can either talk SU football recruiting, or we can talk about a certain divisional game in the NFL last week that I doubt you want to bring up.
Yeah, recruiting it is. Let's do that. Let's talk about that.
All right. So, as anyone who's following SU football is aware, the team has been hemorrhaging recruits, but has also been adding recruits. At this point, there's not a whole lot left from Scott Schaefer's original class, which had a decent amount of guys, but we've added a bunch of guys who may or may not, we think may, based on Baber's pursuit of them, fit Baber's system better. The most recent move was, of course, Andrew Armstrong from Ohio commits, and Taylor Riggins from New York decommits, both linebackers, both playing outside, both shifting between 2 and 3 stars, depending on the recruiting service you read. Dan, your thoughts, do you think that losing Riggins is big on its face? And I know we talked about a little bit on Slack today. Do you think that this class's large kind of exodus from the Northeast, there's only one Northeast player in the class right now, do you think that its absence of Northeast players is a sign of things to come, or just kind of a product of the short time frame that Babers and his staff had to work with?
I'd say probably more the latter than the former. The Northeast, like, people want to, you know, land all these New York recruits. I know Marone did it a little bit. They're just, like, honestly, aren't, like, outside of a couple spots, New Jersey, parts of Pennsylvania, there's, like, the Northeast is just not a fertile recruiting ground. So it's way easier to build connections when you are a coach coming from Bowling Green. You have all of these connections to high schools in Ohio and Illinois and Michigan. It's easier to go to those schools where you know the kids, you know who's there, you know there's a higher quality of football and way more depth in terms of Division I prospects, and taking kids from there than finding diamonds in the rough from New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut, where you haven't really been as a coach. So I think as Babers, you know, starts to coach here and establish himself and installs his program, his system, which we've talked about is going to be very different from the other things that our rival local schools have. I think it'll be very natural for him to reach out to the New York high schools and the Connecticut's and the Massachusetts's and the rest of the schools where we get a couple guys a year. But it's a lot to ask him to build those relationships, you know, in 1 month and go and be sure that he's getting a quality kid that is going to be able to contribute at the ACC level. So I'm not very concerned. Obviously, you'd like to have a big presence in New Jersey. The staff didn't really shake out that way, but we have, you know, a couple alumni and other people who started it in with the Schaefer regime who will hopefully still be there. Overall, I think he's just trying to build the best class he can in a short period of time. We've seen the struggles. Like, Schaefer obviously was a lot less of a transition from Marone, but even then, like, a lot of that class left. Guys like Gus Edwards, names blanking on me, the running back who went to Indiana.
Class was decimated.
Yeah, like half of the best players left. And I know that's largely the case here, but I think that class is probably shaping up to be better than this one in terms of what Marone had coming in. And you still have Moneal, Rex Culpepper, Stu Bradshaw, Jamal Holloway, all players that were, you know, the guys who have stuck around are pretty quality guys that we really want to keep. A lot of them are already on campus. I don't think there's a huge difference between the guys who have decommitted and the guys who have replaced them. I think they're all pretty similar players in terms of quality on a national level. And the biggest difference is the style. Like, even on defense, there's a real shift in what we're trying to do and what the philosophy is. So the right players for Schaefer's system, not for better or worse, not saying it's, you know, they're better or worse players, they just aren't going to fit the system that we have on either side of the ball as well now. So I think we just have to trust. I know he's talked about it a lot in the few media things he's done, but having like the blind faith, I think we just need to trust that Babers is doing the right thing for his program, which he knows a lot more about than we do. And I think we'll all be a lot more excited about things when he has a full year to put together his recruiting boards and go after the players that he's identified early and hopefully put an exciting product on the field for a year. So I think we just have to kind of live with what happens this year. I still think there's a decent chance we wind up with some nice players because there are so many kids coming to visit the next couple weekends. And hopefully we'll have a nice turnout at the basketball game, which I will be at. I'm excited about that. This weekend at Georgia Tech. But overall, I mean, first year recruiting classes, sometimes they see a big bump and sometimes, you know, there's adjustments to be made. This is probably more the latter, but overall, I don't think it's going to be much of a worse class or a better class or anything than what Schaefer brings in. I think it'll be pretty similar in terms of where the rankings shake out.
Yeah, you know, I think this is kind of echoing a lot of the conversations that I've had with folks on Twitter and on in the comments. It just seems like there's, you know, this jaded kind of cynicism, and that sounds stupid coming from me to a lot of people, I'm sure, but it seems like there's this cynicism toward, you know, any coach at this point, and the fact that Babers shook things up and really kind of made some shifts and has changed a lot of this class. I mean, I think some of the kids, they were much more dedicated to Schaefer and staff than the school, and others, it wasn't a fit. And, you know, Babers didn't really pursue maybe as hard as those kids felt like they needed to be pursued. And you know what? I'm not gonna pretend that I was in those meetings and those conversations and everything else. I mean, these things happen, and they happen anytime there's a coaching turnover. It happens sometimes when there isn't a coaching turnover. You know, you mentioned a lot of the kids that are either, some of the kids already on campus, think, you know, Culpepper and Neal. And then, you know, a kid that was added late by a member of the staff that's not even on the staff anymore might be one of the best players in it, and that's Kenny Ruff. Who seems like a perfect fit at the outside linebacker spot. In general, it just seems like, again, this might not be markedly better than what Schaefer was bringing in from a raw numbers standpoint, but it's going to fit. And for anyone who thinks that Baylor's going to come in and suddenly just start raiding recruiting classes, you know, up the Eastern Seaboard and down to Miami and all this other stuff, like, we offered a ton of kids from Miami. We still have recruits from the Miami area and from Florida in general. But by and large, the list that he had and the guys that he was targeting at Bowling Green, I mean, Bowling Green was doing well enough where he could be looking at these high threes and low fours and was looking at these high threes and low fours in the Midwest area. And that's kind of what he's working with. It's what his staff's working with, is guys that he brought over. There's still a lot of names that we could potentially see. I know there hasn't been an offer or visit set up, but I still think Kentrell Moran over at Illinois is somebody to keep an eye on. I know Reese down in Florida. That one, to me, I feel like if there are doubters left about how this class is shaking out and how it's shifting, picking up Reese, who's a Florida State, big on Florida State's board, it seems, if we can grab him, I feel like any sort of doubts left will be gone. I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong there, Dan, because I know that one player doesn't make a class, but I feel like what a lot of people are looking for is a surefire four-star kid who's actually going to show up on campus, and we just haven't had that in so long.
Yeah, I mean, the day that happens, I think it will be the day that we get a lot of the people turned. I think it is kind of weird, the reaction some people have had, though. Like, there's a lot of people who just seem to, you know, be determined to discredit Babers right off the bat. And I don't think anything that's happened has earned that. So it might just be fatigue from, you know, the rapid fire turnover that we haven't ever really had with this program before, or, you know, the athletic department in general. So hopefully we get some good news to wrap up, because there's not many things that are more annoying as a college football fan than your fans getting impatient over recruiting stuff when so much of it is a crapshoot that we won't really know the results of or the future of for 4 years anyway.
Completely fair point, and I would echo those. I know we did this last year. I figured might as well start now, since we have time at the end of the show right now. that'll be different as National Signing Day gets a little bit closer. But a little bracketology action. Dan, completely unprepped. Who are your four number one seeds right now?
Oh, don't do that to me. let me look. I think Oklahoma, I think you have to have them up. Obviously, they lost this week, but who hasn't? I think they have the best player in the country, or at least one of them. And they just seem like they play together pretty well. They're not overwhelmingly talented as a group, but they have, you know, when you have one great guard and a couple other nice complimentary shooters and then some solid interior play like this year, that gets you by. I think North Carolina, maybe the most talented roster overall, at least in terms of depth. I think they're going to end up winning the ACC, and that'll be worth a lot, although I see them seeing a couple other losses down the stretch. I think Kansas will wind up as a number one as well. I don't know if they'll win the Big 12 for the 85th time in a row, but I think they and Oklahoma will be in a really close battle down the stretch, and I think they'll do enough to get one of the four seeds. And last, it's tough. I'm going to go with Maryland. I feel like Maryland hasn't quite played up to what we've expected. They've looked pretty shaky in some games, and they've obviously dropped a few. I just think Melo Trimble is such a dynamic player, and he, you know, is a quintessential lead guard. He wants the shot down the stretch, and he's made some huge plays this year. And I think someone, you know, winning the Big Ten, if they do, is worth a lot. So I think Maryland right now. But there's so many teams that could fill in there. But then they rotate every week at this point.
You took my damn surprise pick, Dan. I was going with the Terps. You and I are pretty high on Melo Trimble last year, and we're talking about Maryland as a potential Final Four team on this podcast last year. And I think they're probably right slotted in there again, except they're better. I'm going to go with the same four, which I know seems weird, considering the fact that this is such an up-and-down season and you know, with no prep. But, yeah, I think Oklahoma and Kansas are the class of the Big 12. Obviously, the Big 12 is a very deep league, and it provides for some struggle. But I think that they're your odds-on favorites in that league. One of them is going to win it, hopefully. I actually hope it's Oklahoma just because I'm sick and tired of seeing Kansas win all the time. I still think Kansas could end up being the number one seed overall, depending on how that shakes out. I think North Carolina probably wins the ACC in impressive fashion in the tournament this year, which could put them in line for the number one seed when all's said and done. I mean, Carolina's played some good teams, but they haven't really had to play the full meat of their schedule. Strength of schedule-wise, it might just bump them up. And then, yeah, that last number one's going to be Maryland, but I think there's going to be a very small separation between them and maybe some of the other teams on that line. You're probably looking at a Villanova there. I'd say I'm not going to buy into West Virginia. I think they might fall a little bit. I buy into an Arizona just because Arizona's going to probably win the Pac-12 again. I think a Texas A&M could potentially be in that conversation down the road. If North Carolina happens to not win the ACC, perhaps, you know, the conversation revolves around whether it's a Duke or a Virginia that hasn't dropped too many games as another number one. This is me fully hating on Villanova too, by the way, but they've earned that right.
Yeah, I think the one that's kind of fallen, you know, and rightfully so based on, you know, tonight and a couple other games, I struggle to see Michigan State not bouncing back. I don't know if they'll do enough to be a number one, but is anyone going to want to face this Michigan State team in March, even if they have like a couple ugly losses during the year?
No, never.
I definitely don't. So
never. That program is the most aggravating one of all, because they're the Spurs of college basketball in that they coast through the regular season, make sure they get in, and get in with a decent positioning, and then just go to the Final Four.
Yeah, I mean, Valentine is a fantastic player. He missed like 4 or 5 games. They haven't looked right since he got back, but you know Izzo's going to have that team playing well. And this team's a lot better than the one last year, I think. And last year, obviously, they made an unexpected Final Four run. So I would not – I think they're kind of falling into bad position to win the Big Ten regular season. But come March, I mean, it's going to be really hard to pick against them in most of these matchups.
Yeah. So looking at overall, like, I mean, since there is so much parity, what team outside of the current top 25 do you think we could see in the Elite Eight?
Ooh, I have to go searching. Outside of the current top 25, huh? How about is Notre Dame ranked? Because Notre Dame,
they are not.
Yeah, they've kind of flown under the radar. They've been playing really well as of late, and I think they have one of the, if not the number one, offensive efficiencies in the country. And obviously, they have kind of a pedigree now after years and years of early flameouts. They have a really nice team. I'm kind of afraid of them. I think they'll still lose a bunch of games down the stretch because this year, but I could see them being like a 6-7 team and going on a bit of a run because they can really score when they're going.
I could buy them. I might have to buy into a team that I'm going to be angry about. I'm going to go Dayton right now just because they've been there. And I just feel like Dayton just seemingly in the last couple of years just knows how to turn it on at the right time. They've done pretty well in March the last couple of years, including against Syracuse, and that's kind of aggravating. But I think that they stand a chance there. St. Mary's is another interesting one. I know some of that might be, you know, going back to the old days about a decade ago when they were kind of chomping at Gonzaga's heels in the West Coast Conference, but they're another one that just seem well situated. And Valpo too. I mean, I'm kind of harping on the mid majors, but I think this could be a year we see a couple of mid majors hanging around the Sweet 16, Elite Eight. I mean, we usually see what, three or four. I think this might be the year we see, you know, six or maybe even seven, and maybe see a couple heading over to the Elite Eight.
Yeah, I think those are pretty good mid-major picks, and obviously Monmouth has fallen out of the top 25, but they have a bunch of really legit wins. I also, I don't know why, I've seen Oregon play a couple times this year, and they are one of those teams that just runs really hot and cold, but they're a pretty fun one when they're playing well.
Yeah, I think Monmouth's a great point. They actually racked up a ton of quality wins against the teams that go in the tournament. That includes both of LA's basketball teams, probably, UCLA and USC. So I guess we'll close oddly on this. USC basketball. Dan, do you believe, do you think that Andy Enfield at the end of the day, while it took a little bit longer, was the right call? And could USC basketball, you know, really be a factor now with, again, Andy Enfield, the coach, somehow within the next couple of years or even this year?
It looks pretty good so far. I mean, they're what, 15-3? I'm looking now. None of their losses are bad. They lost at Washington by two. That's not a great team, but I mean, that's
they're a bubble team.
Yeah, they're okay. And you know, losing at Washington through the year is not the worst thing. The other two losses, they lost to Monmouth, but they also beat Monmouth because they had one of those weird scheduling quirks where they played twice. And then they lost to Xavier, who is right now like number five in the country. So they look pretty good. I haven't had a chance to really watch them play. I don't know if they really resemble those Florida Gulf Coast teams, but like, there's no reason why you can't build a pretty successful basketball program at USC. Obviously, football is going to be king there for, you know, a good long while, but maybe for a couple of years now, we've kind of joked about how they should have definitely hired Hopkins instead of Enfield, and we were kind of glad they didn't. But, I mean, Enfield built a really good program at Gulf Coast.
Out of nothing.
Like, no one knew what that school was, like, at all. We weren't aware it existed until they did, you know, had one of my favorite tournament wins ever. But USC, obviously, probably an easier place to build a pretty relevant program, and he's recruited fairly well, it seems like. And I mean, I haven't really had a chance to watch them play, so I don't know if they're dropping, you know, crazy dunks all over the place. It doesn't seem like it because I don't see a ton of them on like SportsCenter, but the Pac-12 is a pretty balanced league, and the fact that they're on top of it's impressive, and they've beaten a couple of the top teams already this year, Arizona, UCLA, etc.
Yeah, I think the Trojans are an interesting case just because, and the Pac-12 is interesting in general. I think what we're starting to see is a league that, no, they're not the quality of Pac-12 football. I think Pac-12 football is top to bottom the best league in the country. From a football standpoint, and I've said that for the last three seasons now, But they also fall victim to their own success. I think in basketball, it's probably about six deep now, which is progress. But you're still looking at some bad programs like Oregon State that just can't seem to find a way to get better. But, you know, you look at this USC team. In some ways, they do have some similarities to a Florida Gulf Coast. They score a ton. I mean, they're averaging almost 85 points a game. They're rebounding really well. They're, you know, top 10 in the country in rebounds per game. They're not playing great defense, but I don't think those Florida Gulf Coast teams really did either. It was just kind of a Havoc style where they would just create opportunities, and that's really where they seem to thrive. Yeah, I wasn't sold on Enfield necessarily, and I hear the chatter. I listen to the local talk radio around here, and it seemed like no one was really buying into USC even as recently as a couple weeks ago. But now, there's a USC team that seems like it doesn't have an amazing resume, but it's beaten beaten a bunch of quality teams, and it hasn't lost to anybody bad yet. So I'm very, very intrigued by what this Trojans team could do. I mean, this could be the best Trojans team potentially in our lifetime, outpacing that O.J. Mayo group from, what, a decade ago or so.
And it would just add an interesting wrinkle to the Pac-12. Obviously, it bottomed out a few years ago when it just was a brutal league outside of, like, Arizona. But it'd be nice, you know, I enjoy those late-night Pac-12 Bill Walton games, and to have a couple more teams other than Arizona and frustrating UCLA be interesting would be nice.
Agreed. So, Dan, before we close out, anything else you want to talk about Syracuse-related? Are we oranged out?
No, I'm excited. Like, I feel like Monday did a great deal to reinvigorate people. This team, obviously the two wins before were nice, and, you know, beating someone by 30 is nice, but winning at Duke and really looking like a team that was, you know, just as good as the Blue Devils in a lot of ways. Obviously it's not a 100% healthy Blue Devils team, but they're still incredibly talented. I just think that, you know, we really needed a win like that. We hadn't had one in a couple of years. Obviously it's been really a long 2.5 seasons. So I know personally, I feel like miles better about the Orange. And just having that kind of excitement level about the team has been missing for a while. Obviously it was so much fun when they were, you know, they made the Final Four run and they had the couple one seeds the previous few years. So hopefully this is I don't expect this team to reach those heights at all. I think this is still a very flawed team, but hopefully we kind of get back to where we were in terms of, like, having this very excited, passionate fan base, which I think kind of went dormant for a few years. And I'm luckily actually catching two games up there next week. I'm going up early so I can see the Notre Dame team on Thursday and the Georgia Tech team on Saturday. And I haven't been to a basketball game at the Dome since we were in the Big East, so I am very excited for that.
Well, I'm very, very jealous. I have not seen a Syracuse basketball game at all. Since the St. John's game in 2010. So it has been a very long time, but that game did see us crowned as Big East regular season champs.
That was a fun one. My last game was the Otto Porter game, so I'd hopefully not like to relive that ever.
Yeah, let's not do that. I remember my last game was, I spent the entire game harassing DJ Kennedy. I decided I was going to be, you know, I was hell-bent on getting floor seats that game. I was about three rows back and, yeah, pretty much harassed Kennedy the entire game with my two roommates from senior year. And I think he went like 1 for 10 from the floor that game or something stupid. We of course, credit ourselves with it, but it was definitely a fun one and definitely a memorable one.
You asked like a horribly inefficient shooting night was a weird thing for DJ Kennedy.
Also fair. Is kind of his MO. On that note, that was Dan. I'm John. You've been listening to Troy Noons is an Absolute podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe over on Blog Talk, on iTunes. And hopefully we have a game this weekend, and go Orange.
Go Orange.